The soil of the United States could actually run out. That was the realization of our next guest as she paced around her White House office back in 2015. You're listening to The Morning Show, and Joe Handelsman's new book, A World Without Soil, The Past, Present, and Precarious Future of the Earth Beneath Our Feet, doesn't just present an easily understandable scientist's explanation of the problem, but it offers a scientist's readily available solution. So what questions do you have about the need to save our soil, especially right here in our backyard? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation this hour. Email always available to you, ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Joe Handelsman, is also the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. Joe, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
So let's take us back to your time as a science advisor inside the White House. You would have the president's ear, and you've had 30 years as a soil microbiologist, and you have this epiphany, this terrible epiphany in your White House office that we are the soil of the United States could actually run out. Take us through that aha moment for us, if you would.
Well, Lee, I grew up in an era, I went to school in an era when soil conservation was at its, I think it's kind of its height. No-till farming had just been invented, and everyone thought that was going to be the solution, that we weren't going to be eroding soil anymore because everyone would switch to no-till farming. And then in the 1980s, there were these great legislative moves by Congress to protect the soil and incentivize farmers to protect the soil, to make it financially feasible for them to do the right thing for the soil. And so after those new legislative efforts took place, I thought we had kind of solved the problem. And if you look at the data, we were dropping our soil erosion rates precipitously. It was fantastic. And so I kind of lost track after that. I thought this was a done deal. You know, soil erosion was no longer the big problem. We had to worry about other things about soil, but not erosion. And so when I was in the White House, I knew I wanted to work on soil in some way and have some sort of initiative to strengthen our soil research and efforts to help farmers benefit their soils. But what I started to find out was that, no, the erosion crisis had come back in full force, that the farm bills had, after those great legislative efforts in the 80s, had eroded the ability of USDA to hold farmers accountable and to give them the incentives to protect their soil. And so the protection weakened, and our erosion rates are quite awful right now. We're eroding soil at 10 times, maybe even close to 100 times the rate at which it's made.
So Joe, lay it out for us. Why is this topsoil erosion a crisis?
Well, topsoil forms pretty slowly. And so it takes about 1,000 years to form an inch of soil. So an inch of soil. And we only have in most of, say, Wisconsin, somewhere between 8 and 12 inches of topsoil. And so, you know, lucky areas may have deeper topsoil and many areas have less, especially if they're on sloped land that has been eroding for a while. But that's not very much soil if it takes 1,000 years to make an inch. And so if you're eroding it at an inch or 2 inches a year, you can sort of do the math very quickly. We're going to be out of soil. Of course, that's not in every place. There are places that are preserving their soil and conserving it and building its health beautifully. There are other places where it's eroding far more rapidly than the national average of 5 tons per acre per year.
Well, and where is soil often eroding here in the Midwest, Joe?
All over the Midwest. There was an appalling study a couple of years ago that showed that across the Corn Belt, which we're in, close to a third of the land in this area has lost most of its topsoil. And so we're already in a crisis mode. We just don't know it yet. And we're compensating for that loss by building up yields on other land where the soil is still deep, or by fertilizing very heavily to try to boost yields. As corn breeders make new varieties, they breed for high yield. And so yields have not declined as much as they might have had we not had those props. But those props will only take us so far. And without soil, we cannot have a decent crop of any sort. But corn is, of course, our most lucrative crop.
We're talking about the erosion of our planet's topsoil and the threat it poses with Jo Handelsman. She's a biologist, microbiologist, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison, and author of the new book, A World Without Soil. So what about globally? What does soil erosion look like around the world right now?
It's very uneven around the world. There are places where it's eroding at literally hundreds of tons per acre per year, which means there won't be very much left soon. There are places where there is no more topsoil and people are farming on the subsoil, which is not very high in fertility, and the yields are usually far, far lower than in the topsoil. And then there are places that are preserving it. And so it's spotty across the world. But on average, we're eroding at a very, very high rate, probably much higher than the United States rate of 5 tons per acre per year. And so the Food and Agriculture Organization has predicted that we only have 60 more years of generally good topsoil across the world. They were a little bit dramatic in the way they worded it. They, you know, the headlines all read that we wouldn't have any topsoil left in 60 years. And of course, that's probably not going to be the case. Nothing is all or none.
Right.
But it does mean that we won't be able to meet the world's needs in 60 years for food and nutrition.
I just want to reiterate, and we will certainly be getting to it, but you probably never even figured that soil erosion could be a serious concern, a dire concern. But there's also a simple solution, and it is not something that we would have to, as I understand it, wouldn't be, it would be low cost up front. It would be long-term savings. So it's not like we're presenting a problem here this morning without solutions. They are readily available. But I am curious this morning, why is there such a lack of urgency to address this issue as you see it, Joe, since you've been in the White House, since you're leading the Institute for Discovery in Wisconsin? Where is the push for to get to these solutions?
I think there's a large push in the farm communities, in some sectors of the farm community. There's some push from our agricultural scientists and from the universities. And what we're lacking are the incentives for farmers. Farmers, you know, we all know in Wisconsin, work on a pretty small margin. Farmers don't get wealthy and have lots of extra capital to invest in new equipment or new methods. And they don't have the capital to take risks. If they take risks, they're often out of business. And so many of them are very reluctant to change their soil management strategies because they just can't take the risk. So that requires the government to step in. That's exactly where governmental regulations actually play a very positive role, and that's in giving them incentives. So setting up crop insurance, setting up, we can talk about the details of those later, but there are many ways to provide farmers with the resources so that they can take that risk to make a change, which may be cost enough to deter them in that first year. But then, as you said, it benefits them over the long haul, and their yields will go up, their fertilizer needs will go down. So we're really just lacking the wherewithal to get over that hump to help farmers make that shift.
Well, how much of this soil erosion underway would occur anyways without any human influence?
Well, soil erosion is a natural process. It's the process that is given us all the great geologic formations across the world. That's erosion in process. The Grand Canyon, of course, is an example of massive erosion. So, of course, erosion happens anyway. But when we look at erosion in farmland, we often will compare it with unfarmed neighboring land. So same kind of soil, the same climate, the same amount of degree of slope in the land. And what we find is that traditionally farmed land erodes much more quickly than the neighboring unfarmed non-agricultural land. So that's our good comparison. But of course, what you know, in the most optimistic view, we could do even better than in the natural land. We could be adding carbon at a much higher rate than the natural land accumulates it.
Jo Handelsman, our guest, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison and author of the new book, A World Without Soil, The Past, Present, and Precarious Future of the Earth Beneath Our Feet. Farmers would be interested in hearing from you about your reaction this morning. 1-800-642-1234. Conservationists, was this on your radar? And will it be now? Tell the stories. Let us know what you see when it comes to the dirt that we all count on one way or another. 60 years on the timeline with the clock ticking and yet solutions on the horizon that are at the ready and could be employed by next month. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. In her new book, A World Without Soil, our guest, Jo Handelsman, explains how the loss of soil could present a real problem for the future of antibiotic discovery. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and unless you're a soil microbiologist like our guest, you likely would never consider it. But as Handelsman writes, that smell following a refreshing summer rain comes from chemicals released by bacteria in our dirt. This living, breathing biome is disappearing, and the ramifications of not doing anything to prevent it, according to our guest, would be nothing short of dire. Jo Handelsman is the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison and author of the new book, A World Without Soil, and we'd be interested in your perspective. Do you even see that? Was this even on your radar? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Aaron in Peshtigo this morning, who is also a farmer and former soil researcher. Aaron, good morning. You're on The Morning Show with Jo Handelsman.
Hey, good morning, Lee. Thanks for taking my call. So I farm up here in Peshtigo, and in a previous life, I worked for UW as a soils researcher, and before that as a county soil conservation employee. And I wanted to just encourage folks out there listening that if soil conservation is important to you, to look beyond some of these labels and hide buzzwords, you know, particularly organic. Some of the worst soil erosion I've ever witnessed has been on organic farms.
What's the connection there? Why is that, Aaron? What's the connection between organic farming and the loss of soil as you've seen it?
Yeah, organic farming, because it precludes the use of synthetic herbicides, requires many passes of cultivation and tillage to fight weeds. And so every time we disturb the soil, you loosen it up and expose it to high erosion potential. So, for example, I was on an organic grain farm not long ago. The guy explained that he takes 7 passes of tillage from planting to through the season in order to grow that crop of corn, as opposed to, you know, a no-till system would be 0 passes of tillage, you know, 1 or 2 passes of herbicide.
Sure.
So while I'm not advocating for, you know, not saying that Roundup and herbicides are the answer, we need to be pragmatic in our approaches, that the occasional herbicide pass and the occasional tillage pass are acceptable. But by bottlenecking ourselves into one system or another, we reduce the amount of tools in our toolbox to fight these problems.
Aaron, I very much appreciate that, because both the plow and synthetic nitrogen fertilizer are addressed in our guest Jo Handelsman's book, A World Without Soil. And you really take the plow to task in your book, Jo.
Yes, Aaron, thank you for your comments. You you certainly nailed that issue of organic farming and soil erosion. I do kind of take the plow to task. The plow, of course, was the instrument that allowed us to open up the Midwest. We never would have been able to farm as, you know, European Americans moved into the Midwest. The soil is dense. It was heavily planted, of course, with the prairie plants, which form this wonderful dense mat of roots. And it would have been very difficult to farm it by hand or without the steel plow. Thomas Jefferson actually invented the moldboard plow, which he said in one of his letters was the greatest invention ever in humankind. And it was amazing. It was what allowed people to open up new land and plow it and turn the soil over and cultivate to, as Aaron said, reduce the weed pressure. But when the plow got to the Midwest, it was iron. And the iron, it turns out, got stuck up and clogged with soil very, very quickly, because we have these heavy, dense, really quite wonderful soils in the Midwest. And it was John Deere, a man in about the 1930s, who invented the steel plow, which the soil doesn't stick to as much. And so it didn't get stuck in the soil. The farmers didn't have to keep stopping to scrape off the soil from the plow. And that was an incredible invention and increased the land that could be broken and developed into agricultural land. So there are a couple of ramifications of the plow. One is that it enabled European Americans to colonize the Midwest of the United States and displace many, many, many indigenous people. And so that was one of the outcomes of being able to foster agriculture so readily with the plow. But the other implication is that after 150 years of plowing, the soil has been degraded enormously. And as Aaron said, it's absolutely fine to plow when the land is first broken to, you know, make it possible to plant seeds. A single pass in a season is probably fine. But that was the idea of no-till planting in the 70s, was to stop plowing because it degrades the soil structure and breaks down the clods and the clumps that we think of as typical of our beautiful Midwestern soils, and makes it much easier for wind and water to erode that soil. So it's been pretty damaging.
So, I mean, back to Aaron's question here, what would be the right approach then when it comes to soil erosion for our farmers?
Well, for organic farmers, I think we owe our organic farmers some really serious research on ways to control weeds. We simply don't have a good answer for them on how to control weeds without plowing. And so intercropping is one way that people have done it in many cultures across the world, you know, growing a second crop between the main crop. That has positives and negatives. There are issues with it, but it is one way of suppressing the weeds and eventually can also create a second crop or at least a plant that can be degraded, decomposed and will nourish the soil. But that's one of the problems. You know, something like 80 or 90% of our cropland is genetically engineered herbicide tolerant crops now. And that's why we spray Roundup. And as much as people think that that's terrible to be spraying a chemical, Roundup is, as chemicals go, chemical pesticides go, it's not that harmful. I'm sure it has many, many liabilities, but it also protects the soil because you can spray the weeds and not have to plow to kill them.
Something I'd never thought of when it comes to organic products or organic produce. And if I could ask you, Joe Handelsman, when it comes to organic in the grocery store, how do you make your choices?
Well, I certainly prefer organic for the reduction in pesticide use. That reduction is important for all sorts of environmental effects on our non-target organisms. Obviously, when you use an insecticide, it's not just killing the insect that is destroying your crop, but it's destroying all sorts of other insects. And so pesticides have gotten a lot safer and they're used at much lower quantities than they used to be. But I certainly prefer organic. But organic is not a panacea because not only does organic farming can have very negative effects on the soil unless people have found other ways of suppressing weeds besides plowing. But it also can lead to fungal infections of crops. And that can lead to mycotoxins, which are some very, very harmful toxins that fungi produce. And that's one of the real contradictions and paradoxes of organic farming is that, yeah, we don't like those synthetic chemicals that we've made in such enormous quantities and used for so many years. But, you know, nature isn't all kind and friendly either. And fungi are particularly damaging to our health.
And you raise this in your book, A World Without Soil, the paradox of agriculture. While farming may raise awareness of soil's value, the necessity of our rich soil, it also fosters to some degree some abuse.
And no question.
Yeah, we'll leave it there because we've got the news coming up, but we've got plenty more questions, and perhaps you have your own with our guest, Joe Handelsman, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison, a soil microbiologist, and the author of the new book, A World Without Soil, Something to Seriously Consider. Aaron, thank you so much for the call this morning from Pesh2Go, and we welcome yours after the news at 1-800-642-1234. Farmers, organic farmers, how do you make the decision about how many passes do you go through your crops in a season? And how do you make that balance between the synthetic nitrogen fertilizer as just a farmer and the passes that you'd make throughout your crops throughout the year? It's not easy, and those margins are ever so slim. So what are you to do to help solve this problem? Solutions are available, and we'll get to them after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn. News is next. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. World Without Soil. It's the title of the new book by our guest, Joe Handelsman. And you're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. And as she explains it, lightning and bacteria used to be the only source for nitrogen across all of this planet. Joe Handelsman, that is. And then in the early 20th century, the mass production of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer revolutionized agriculture. And with that, our dirt changed forever, leaving us today with questions about when we'll seriously begin to act to save our soil. Joe Handelsman's the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery and the author of the new book, A World Without Soil. We invite you to our conversation with your questions, comments, and experiences at 1-800-642-1234. Email available, ideas@wpr.org. And Joe, Sharon called from Nakwa, couldn't stay with us, and she says that we are so heavily dependent on synthetic nitrogen for fertilizer. Since our soil isn't just made up of dirt, she wants to know what the impacts of synthetic nitrogen on the living soil structure could be, and whether or not that is accelerating soil loss.
Oh, that's a great question, Sharon. Thanks for asking that. Nitrogen by itself is not causing soil loss. It has other very serious liabilities. One is that often nitrogen will form compounds that get into our groundwater, and nitrates in the groundwater are really not healthy at all for us. The other, which is probably even more serious, is that when we pour the nitrogen on in excess quantities, excess meaning more than the plants can take up, the excess can go either to the groundwater or it can be turned into nitrous oxide by bacteria in the soil, and it ends up in the atmosphere. And nitrous oxide is not that long lived in the atmosphere, but while it's around, it is one of the most serious greenhouse gases in terms of absorbing heat and holding on to it. So nitrous oxide has a very detrimental effect on our climate. So nitrogen used in excess is definitely a problem for us. It also will change the nature of the soil community, but community meaning all the bacteria, fungi, viruses, and other organisms that live in the soil. But that's probably not its most serious challenge to our environment.
And mentioned this before, but it is part of the story, part of your book, A World Without Soil, and that is the search for antibiotics in the dirt. And why you worry soil loss poses a threat to future discoveries of antibiotics. Can you explain how that could be?
Yes, it's a very, very interesting connection that most of us don't recognize. Most of the antibiotics that we take, you know, we're used to taking ampicillin and doxycycline and all those, either come from bacteria in the soil or are derivatives, you know, chemical modifications of the bacterial antibiotics. It was less than a century ago when people discovered that soil bacteria produce massively diverse and high quantities when we coddle them and make them cooperate with us. They can be made to make large quantities of these antibiotics. The chemistry of soil bacteria is just astounding. They have a virtuosity that I think our human chemists would love to have. We've never been able to duplicate the drug arsenal that we get from the soil in the laboratory. And so a number of years ago, the pharmaceutical companies said, oh, we're kind of done with the soil. There's nothing left to get there. But we know that's not true. We know from sequencing the genomes of soil bacteria that many of them contain two dozen pathways, even just amazing numbers of pathways for synthesis of antibiotics, but they're silent. And if we can figure out how to turn those on and get the bacteria not just to hold the genetic material to make the pathways, but to make the antibiotics, but actually to produce those antibiotics, there is a treasure trove of antibiotics to be discovered in soil. And we're facing an antibiotic resistance crisis among our bacterial pathogens. Many of our pathogens are very difficult, or in some cases impossible to treat with our standard arsenal of antibiotics. And so we need new antibiotics. There's of course a lot of redundancy in the soil, and what you find in one in terms of an antibiotic in one soil is very often what you find in another. But there are examples of antibiotics that have only been found once. Mm. Vancomycin is an example, very important antibiotic, sort of the antibiotic of last resort for a lot of infections these days. And that was only found once in all of the searches that we did for, you know, most of the last 100 years. So if that soil clod that vancomycin was discovered in had been eroded and ended up, you know, at the either buried someplace or in the ocean or wherever it might go, we never would have found vancomycin.
And before we get back to the phones here, Joe, why was this search in the soil for antibiotics personal for you?
In the 1980s, my mother developed a bacterial infection in her lungs. And at first, we thought it was just a regular pneumonia that could be treated. And it was. The antibiotics worked at first. But then it kept recurring. And she had an immunological problem that made her susceptible to repeated bacterial infections in her lungs. And eventually, after years and years of taking antibiotics and then switching to different antibiotics, the bacteria not only had done enormous damage to her lungs, but they had also developed tremendous resistance to antibiotics. And eventually the antibiotics just stopped working and she died from an antibiotic resistant bacterial infection. So it was one of those really sad ironies of life that here I ran a lab that one of the things we've always done is study antibiotics in soil, and I couldn't discover one fast enough to save my mother. So it's always been a very personal mission for me.
We're talking about the intersection of topsoil erosion and modern agriculture and technology, medicine with Joe Handelsman. It's all there in our dirt. She's a professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, director of the Institute for Discovery, Wisconsin, at UW-Madison, and author of the new book, A World Without Soil. And in that book, you do talk about the lessons from the past that perhaps we've forgotten, former cultures that may have known more about soil erosion than we think we know now.
Absolutely. There are cultures that have been farming very productively the same soil for thousands of years. The Maya of Mexico and Central America are one of the best examples. There aren't a lot of Maya left, but the ones that are still farming that very same land, and they haven't eroded their soil. Their soil is very rich. And in fact, there are areas in South America where you can fly over, and using the right equipment, you can see these very dark patches in certain areas in the soil. And that's from human activity. And those dark patches are where there's more soil than in the natural surrounding area. It's where people have nourished the soil so well that the soil has gotten deeper and richer, more fertile than it was before. So, and those are what we would call indigenous people, long lived societies in those areas. Other societies, of course, have done terrible damage to their soil, and they've disappeared in very often a couple hundred years because they just run out of soil. That's a very common story in history. But the beautiful stories are the ones of these cultures that have been farming so intelligently that their soil has sometimes increased in depth, not decreased like what we're doing to our soil.
Joe Handelsman, our guest, and your opportunity at 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation as we look at a world without soil and what we can do to save it. Scott in Iowa, you are on the air this morning with Joe Handelsman. Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I've been catching your program in and out as I've been working here today, so I hope I didn't miss this, but I wanted to point out when we discussed earlier funguses in organic food. Anyway, there are good types of fungus and bad types of fungus. Certainly some will make us sick, but I think that there, at least from what I've been learning about soils, there's many good types of fungus and in the soil that we need to propagate. And as an organic farmer here in Northeast Iowa, I do agree with the fact that organic is not always a panacea. We do a lot of tillage to prevent weeds. But a lot of times we've been developing areas where we're trying to propagate the better types of fungus so that they basically, for lack of a better term, overpower the negative types of fungus that we might have that cause us health concerns. And I can't speak to fruit and vegetables, but at least in the grain industry, we have standards that we have to meet before anybody is going to eat our food in the food chain, human food chain, and that is to be under 2 parts per billion, I believe, vomitoxin. A lot of organic farmers out here are trying to not only promote soils in having healthy bacteria, but also healthy fungal systems as well, to in turn to grow the healthiest crop that we can.
Scott, I appreciate you taking time out of your work this morning to join our conversation and add this to the equation. The good and bad funguses and how organic farmers are cultivating the good fungus. What stories have you heard about that, Joe?
Well, I really thank Scott from Iowa for sharing that. He's absolutely right. Fungi are a wonderful and important part of our ecosystem, and I didn't mean to imply that all fungi were bad. In fact, most fungi are great. It's just like bacteria. We think of the pathogens first, but they're actually a teeny tiny proportion of all our bacteria, and most of the bacteria we couldn't manage without. So absolutely, soil fungi are great. The ones that have been a problem there are just a few, but we tend to create conditions, nice moist conditions, with lots of nutrients for them in stored grain and apples and various fruits and mostly in storage, where that they're just perfect conditions for these toxin-producing fungi to exist. And so he's absolutely right. Scott said that there are requirements, for example, for milk. We can't have aflatoxin, which is one of the bad ones in milk, which gets there from the grain that the cows eat if it's infected. Same with the grains. We can't have the toxins in grains. So yes, there are maximum tolerances that we have for many of these toxins. But we don't know all of them. And that is just a risk of eating food, frankly, right, is we don't know when it's infected. I've always been intrigued by what I call the blueberry problem. My blueberries will at some point turn quite fuzzy and white with a fungus. And I always wonder, well, how much is in there before I can actually see it? Because they're microscopic.
Right.
And so I always think about eating fungi and mycotoxins when I eat my fruits, because those are fruits that are very vulnerable to fungal infection. So
well, now
I'm not
going to be thinking about that.
No. Don't stop eating blueberries. They're great for you. But, on balance, of course, our fruits, vegetables, and all of our plants are better to eat than not to eat. But it is one of the risks that we take in any food supply is what are the organisms that have infected and maybe left undesirable chemicals behind.
All this from just digging in our dirt this morning with our guest, Joe Handelsman, who's been doing it for more than 30 years. She's the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison and the author of the new book, A World Without Soil. We get to the solutions next, and it's not too complicated and it's not too costly, according to our guest. We'll get the details next. You can join us 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So the good news is that there are solutions available, and according to our guest this hour, they are neither costly nor complex. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and the bad news may be that not enough of us have yet to even consider soil erosion to be a dire problem. Jo Handelsman does. She's the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison and the author of the new book, A World Without Soil: The Past, Present, and Precarious Future of the Earth Beneath Our Feet. What questions do you have for her before we're out of time this morning? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. VG in Kenosha joins us this morning. VG, you're on The Morning Show with Jo Handelsman.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I want to thank you so much for doing this program. I got involved with this organization, Isha, and they do this consciousplanet.org, where we're trying to bring the entire world into this awareness that soil is the thing, right? Without soil, we don't exist.
And, I've started to realize this hour that the interconnectedness of all of us can be found right there in our dirt. So what was that website again, VG?
Exactly. What is that again?
What was the website that you gave out?
ConsciousPlanet.org or SaveSoil.org.
SaveSoil.org. And Joe, do we know, Save the Soil is a movement that you'd like to see start. What do you know about the SaveSoil.org, if anything?
Save Soil is a wonderful movement that is a worldwide effort to save the soil, to build its organic matter, which makes it healthier. They have a wonderful spokesman, Sadhguru, who has been traveling throughout Europe just a few months ago. He traveled on his motorbike across Europe and spoke about soil. I think then he went to Africa and he's been talking about soil. And so Save Soil is fabulous. They're doing great work in terms of raising awareness. But we also need movements that actually work at the national level, where we have policy that can help farmers, because awareness is a gigantic issue. And I'm enormously grateful to them for making sure that people know about the soil problem. But we also need both international and national policies that will encourage the right practices to build soil on farms.
Yeah, VG, thank you for the call and getting us started on solutions. As you told the Wisconsin Science Festival last October, Joe, soil can be saved, probably by one act, something we could engage in as a country just next month. What would that one act be?
Well, I think that one act that I was talking about was signing on to the international agreement called 4 per 1,000, which was introduced in the climate talks in 2015 by the French minister, who said that we should all contribute 0.4% more carbon to the soil. And if we increased the soil carbon by 0.4%, that would offset the increase in all emissions over the next decade, or at that point, it was probably 15 years by 2030. And so that was an international agreement, which is still in place. Many countries have signed on, and the United States still has not signed on to that agreement. And if we agreed to that and then lived up to it, we would solve a big portion of the soil problem, no question. So I think that's what I meant by next month in that case, because the Glasgow climate talks were a month after the Wisconsin Soil Festival. But we could take a few steps toward that goal very, very quickly. And we don't need to have the international agreement in order for farmers to take those steps. And the three things that really preserve soil are, as we talked about earlier, no-till farming. So reducing the amount of the number of passages of tillage across the fields, and using plows in a more minimal, modest way, rather than dozen passes per season. The second is cover crops. In Wisconsin, our land is barren for most of the year.
Right.
So from the time we harvest the crops till the time we plant the next crop, there in most of our land, there's no plant life there. And plant life is what holds the soil and nourishes the soil. And so cover crops are what we plant after we harvest the main crop in the fall, and then leave those plants growing or even just sitting and freezing over the winter, and they will help hold the soil in place. You know, before COVID, when I used to travel, I would be appalled at when you fly over the Midwest, how much land before the snow cover comes, how much land is just barren. You just see brown soil across acres and acres, and that should never be. We should always have cover crops in our land. And then the third part is incorporating more organic matter, and that can be either by intercropping, which has been done in a project in Iowa absolutely wonderfully, just replacing 10% of the corn with these deep-rooted prairie plants that formed the soil of the Midwest in the first place, that hold the soil, nourish the soil, add carbon to the soil. Just 10% of the field in those cover crops reduced erosion by 90%. So there are a few practices that make a very, very big difference.
Yeah, Joe Handelsman, so no-till farming, cover crops, more organic matter in the dirt, like using intercropping, these seem like simple solutions. I'm not sure how difficult it would be to increase our soil carbon by 0.4%, but 0.4% sounds awfully small to me. Would this be a big hurdle in terms of solutions?
I think getting anything to be done on a large scale is a big hurdle. I think we found that whether we're thinking at the national level or at the international level. So I'm not going to say that it's easy, but for any individual farmer to make that change, I don't think is an enormous hurdle. The issue for farmers is the financial one.
Right.
And, you know, as we've heard from all these callers who do organic farming and soil conservation, Aaron and Scott and Sharon, absolutely. You know, farmers have made this switch without a whole lot of incentives from the government. But we also need to get rid of these perverse disincentives that we have. You know, for example, what I discovered when I was in the White House and I could not figure out a way to solve this is that if a farmer takes 10% of their corn out of production to replace it with these prairie plants, the strip cropping that we talked about to prevent soil erosion, they get 10% less crop insurance.
Oh.
Well, who can afford that, right? That's just a disincentive to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And it seems on the face of it, so easy to change the crop insurance rules. I wasn't able to do it, but I hope that somebody else can.
So crop insurance would be a part of supporting our farmers as they continue to operate on the slimmest of margins and continue to operate with a disappearing topsoil that becomes, for our guest, a soil microbiologist, a serious concern, a dire concern if left unaddressed, and yet the solutions are available. No-till farming, cover crops, more organic matter. It's all right there. Joe, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me, Lee. This has been a great hour.
Agreed. Joe Handelsman, the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. Encourage you to check out her new book, A World Without Soil. It's also a world with solutions. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent this morning, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.